Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's foreign minister in Mali at the start of a two-nation tour as part of plans to forge tighter political and economic bonds with Africa. Iran calls for the United States to show a real commitment to nuclear disarmament and for Israel to eliminate its stockpile of nukes. And the Hezbollah chief recounts victories against Israel as the Lebanese movement celebrates 40 years of resistance. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has arrived in the Malian capital, Bamako, for high-level talks with the West African country's officials. Amir Abdollahian says his trip is in line with Tehran's policy of comprehensive improvement of ties with African states. Mahdi Abbasian has more from Bamako.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in the Malian capital, Bamako, on the first leg of his African tour, which will later take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar. Amir Abdollahian is heading a high-ranking political and economic delegation. A group of representatives of several private sector companies also accompanies him during his visit. The top diplomat was welcomed by his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop. Upon arrival at Bamako's international airport, the Malian foreign minister called the visit a sign of Iran's will to enhance ties with the African country. Amir Abdollahian confirmed that Tehran seeks all-out expansion of relations with Mali and has special plans for this purpose.
I am confident that we will start a new chapter of relations between Tehran and Mali under the government of President Raisi.
Amir Abdollahian is scheduled to also meet with Mali's interim president during his stay before he departs for Tanzania on Wednesday. The visit is part of a wider policy roadmap in Iran. The foreign ministry says Tehran is looking to expand ties with African nations, including Mali, in the fields of economy, banking, and trade.
Mahdi Abbasian, Bamako. Iran underlines the need for the U.S. to show genuine commitment to nuclear disarmament and creation of a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations expressed deep concern regarding the lack of progress in the implementation of nuclear disarmament obligations. Majid Takht-Ravanchi made the remarks during the 10th review conference of the parties to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. The Iranian official also called for Israel's accession to the NPT without preconditions and for elimination of the regime's nuclear weapons. Israel is widely believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads. However, the regime has not admitted holding a stockpile. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails the victory of the resistance against Israel in 2000. Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a ceremony to mark the 40th anniversary of Hezbollah's establishment. We discuss that in our news review program. Here's the full story and our guest's take on the issue.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the Hezbollah leader says the victory of resistance in the year 2000, which saw Israel withdraw its forces from Lebanon, ended the Greater Israel Project.
The year 2000 victory and its results in the struggle, in the Israeli-Palestinian struggle, this liberation ended the greater Israeli project. Then we had the Intifada in Al-Aqsa, and it destroyed the image of the invincible army. It also gave a good image of a humanistic and a humanitarian resistance and a military group. And this was given by all the resistance groups in the year 2000, in May of 2000, in the liberation. The resistance Africa's giving.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks during a televised speech to a ceremony marking the 40th anniversary of the establishment of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. He also hailed Hezbollah's victory in the 33-day war against Israel in 2006 as one of the most important achievements. He said the victory ended the U.S.'s so-called Greater Middle East Initiative. Nasrallah also highlighted Hezbollah's vital role in defending the Daesh terrorist group in Syria and defeating the Daesh terrorist group, that is. He said that the Palestinian cause is part of Lebanon's religion, culture, and honor, and vowed to stand by oppressed nations in the region, including Yemen. Nasrallah also vowed that Hezbollah will not be dragged into a civil war in Lebanon. To discuss that further, we're joined by Firas Al-Najim, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us live from Ottawa, and also Julia Qasim, journalist and political analyst, also joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Firas Al-Najim. If you could please tell us what you think was the most important part of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's speech tonight.
Yes, I'd like to congratulate the Lebanese nation for their victories and for securing their nation. I mean, he made a lot of very important points, but the point that he made that was very important, I think that the resistance is the only solution with the Zionist regime. And the achievements that they were able to successfully get from the results of all these sacrifices and these struggles for all these years showed that Lebanon can be a sovereign country, that you know, the security of the country can also be organized, and having a country where they can walk around freely and safely without having occupiers with their guns pointed at them and invading and attacking and killing and blowing up people and so on. And we see that every day in Palestine, what's going on and how the people are living under the Israeli occupation. It's the worst life. And Hezbollah was able, with their allies, Amal, and different groups that were, in alliance, they were able to successfully kick the Israelis out of their country, remove them fully, and, to unite the country. You know, there was also a civil war inside the country. Many people were dying inside, and there was a lot of even political parties that were clashing with each other. And, now we see the results that, you know, the country's secure and the people are united and they have a good leadership, especially under the resistance front and the resistance group Hezbollah, that is obviously integrated in the democratic system in Lebanon and has MPs and has a lot of different allies. He mentioned the normalization and how the Israelis are trying to exploit it and use it, to their interest. And it's only going to serve the Israelis and not serve the Arab countries and the Muslim countries in the region, because Israel is only after its own benefit and its own interest, and that is to control the whole region and have everybody, under its system, under its power, under its influence, under its allies. So, the resistance is the main solution, and look what happened in 2000, that, Lebanon was freed and people were able to celebrate. And then we've seen what happened in 2006 when resistance was being tested again, and we've seen the results as well. The resistance was very firm, steadfast in their battles, and they were able to humiliate the Zionists and also release every Lebanese prisoner. You know, we have countries like Jordan that normalize with Israel, and they still have, Jordanian citizens that are in Israeli jails that don't have their freedom. And that's because they're a weak regime, because this is a weak alliance, this is a weak agreement. You get nothing from the Zionists. The Zionists are war criminals and mercenaries that want to fully control any nation they get a hold of. And the countries that normalize with Israel are going to see the bad results very soon, especially the UAE and Bahrain and all these regimes.
Okay, so Mr. Al-Najim, let's bring in Julia Qasim to tell us more about what you mentioned, particularly the year 2000 and the year 2006. Julia, tell us, how did this shatter the so-called Greater Middle East Initiative?
So he mentions the Greater Middle East Initiative of the American occupation with the 2006 victory, coinciding with the most apparent decline of the American stronghold in Iraq during its occupation there. But he also mentioned the Greater Israeli Project. As we know, Israel is a it's an illegal entity. It is a acts as a military base for the West. And with the victories in 2000 and 2006, it showed that not only did it stop the existential expansionist project in its tracks, but it actually reversed the scale of its occupation and forced Israel to concede, to retreat. And this was unprecedented in history. In Nasrallah's latest speech today, he underlined the eminent oil and gas demarcation line issue as a representative of another case in which the resistance's strength and force, which he made clear time and time again that he and Hezbollah was not, were not, are not able to, are not afraid of using to protect the sovereignty of Lebanese resources. Is going to be applied should Israel also deny this too. So Israel is taking this threat very, very seriously. It was mentioned in Al-Akhbar on Friday that Israel even is mulling over agreeing to negotiating on or giving Lebanon the Qana in the Line 23. But the resistance is made clear, and it seems like the Zionist entity is taking very seriously the threat by Nasrallah over any infringement on the resources of the Karish, of the Mediterranean, which, as they are occupied Palestine's resources. But another thing is that Nasrallah not only reminisced on the past in highlighting a monumental achievement of the resistance, but also gave a trajectory and a vision of how our sovereignty looks like going forward.
Thank you very much, Firasal Najim, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights from Ottawa, and Julia Qasim, journalist and political analyst. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of you for following us.
A young Palestinian man has succumbed to the injuries he sustained in an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus on August the 9th. Earlier, we reached out to our correspondent in Ramallah, Mono Kandil, to get more details. Let's take a listen.
2 weeks ago, there was a major operation in Nablus where the Israeli troops were following or chasing one of the Palestinian fighters. He is a leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim al-Nablusi. And during this operation, three Palestinians were shot dead, Ibrahim al-Nablusi and his friend Islam Sabouh, as well as 16-year-old Hussein Taha. Today, one Palestinian who was wounded during the operation, Mohammed Arashi, in his 20s, succumbed to his injuries. He was in hospital since August 9, since this operation had taken place. We have to mention that at that day, at least 60 Palestinians were wounded during the Israeli military raid to Nablus, northern the occupied West Bank. Today as well, Israeli troops raided several Palestinian towns and cities like Tobas, as well as Beit Lahem and Ramallah, arresting 10 Palestinians during the Israeli military raid to these areas.
Elsewhere, Yemeni officials say world bodies, including the UN, lack integrity and transparency in their humanitarian work in the war-torn country where millions of people struggle each and every day to get themselves some food. Abdul Latif Al-Mashali reports from Sana'a.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore, they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Programme said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Ablatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey says there is ongoing dialogue between Turkish and Syrian intelligence organizations, stressing that Ankara considers no preconditions for talks with Damascus. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu says, however, that any such discussion should be goal-oriented. Çavuşoğlu says getting Syria cleared of terrorists is among those goals. Ankara has recently softened its tone towards Syria. Turkey's president has hinted at willingness to restore ties with Damascus. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says his country cannot totally cut off diplomatic relations with Syria. The two countries have had no diplomatic relations since the beginning of the war on Syria after Ankara supported anti-Damascus militants. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has asked for a pause to the review of materials recovered during the raid on his Florida home by the FBI. Trump wants, has filed a lawsuit asking the federal court to appoint a special master to oversee the review. This is to make sure the investigators do not go through privileged information. Trump has also requested a more detailed receipt of the property seized during the August 8th operation. He wants items outside the scope of the search warrant to be returned. The Justice Department says 11 sets of classified materials were removed from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. The details are withheld, but the cash reportedly contained top-secret documents on national defense. Well, the United States Court has upheld an international tribunal's ruling that orders Venezuela to pay $8.7 billion to American oil company ConocoPhillips. The court says Caracas should make the payment for seizing the energy firm's assets in Venezuela under former President Hugo Chavez. The Venezuelan government has denounced the verdict. It says the decision was taken in collusion with what it calls Venezuelan extremists. Caracas also says it would take legal action to, quote, preserve its patrimony. Venezuela seized Caracas' assets in 2007. It led to an arbitration dispute at a World Bank panel, which the American company won in 2019. The panel ruled Venezuela to pay billions of dollars in compensation. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. What stands up to Shaitan's camp? The camp of struggle and jihad on the way of Allah. Well, you are the hay'ats. You should ask your own hay'at where it stands in this jihad. This is the point I wanted to make. The second point is that we should ask ourselves where we stand in the battle that exists, in the relentless battle between Islam and disbelief, between truth and falsehood, and between deceitful and truthful narratives. We must determine this for ourselves and be sure, where do we stand? Of course, what is meant is the clarification and promotion of the ideals and main principles of the revolution. These are the areas where mostly we must determine where we stand. But minor political and social issues are also involved in this battle, and we should pursue these as well. Another point about the hay'ats concerns the speakers, the elegists, and the audience.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Two important solid pillars of hay'ats are the speakers and the elegists. I have points to discuss about the speakers that should be discussed with the right people on another occasion. I wish to raise two or three points about elegies, which are related to you, dear ones. One is that, as I said, reading elegies is a unique art. In other words, there is no art like it in other places. In other countries and places, they use the art of supplication, accompanied by mourning and weeping, but that is different from reading elegies. Elegies are of a different nature, and as I said, the relationship between the audience and the artist is a special relationship. It purifies and enlightens the hearts of the audience. The tears that your audience shed come from the heart. When hearts were being molded on that day, dewdrops of love were added to them. When the hearts were mixed with those dewdrops, they became like salted kebab. These tears originate from the heart and they purify it. In addition, elegies take the audience into the depths of history and do not let people linger in the present time. The elegists take people into the depths of history and show them historic truths. They also teach people lessons in religion, morals, and politics. An elegist does all these things. So elegies involve religious, moral, and political teachings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader. on the news line.
The fall of the US dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there is a decline in the US standing as a superpower, there is also the harsh reality that the US is facing, the decline of the US dollar. All the signs are there. Shares of the US dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. The US, the most indebted nation ever, also has a sovereign debt crisis, another sign that it may be heading to a dollar collapse. The US use of the dollar as a weapon, like sanctions, has made other countries resist using it in their trade. Yet countries like Iran, Russia, and China are moving towards the elimination of the dollar altogether. This is why Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said, against the growing geopolitical pressure from the collective West, the only way to guarantee stable trade, economic and investment ties between Russia and its partners is to avoid the dollar and the euro and switch to settlements in acceptable alternatives, primarily in national currencies. His reference to the growing geopolitical pressure from the West are sanctions from the US and its European allies due to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. But these sanctions have been heavily used against Russia starting from the year 2014.
When it comes to trade, if you want to move away from the dollar, as we're supposed to say, Russian ruble, it's going to be very difficult indeed. Of course, you can trade in ruble and other currencies, but the key thing is you need them to be liquid. That's to say, easy to buy and sell and a decent size. And also the margin or the difference between the buying and selling costs, all of this can make it more difficult. Therefore, if you're trading in dollars, the price is normally going to be sharper. If you're trading in, say, another currency, well, you may find it's illiquid, as barren as a desert, and not be able to complete your trade.
The de-dollarization move was thrown into fast gear when the US Treasury Department decided to confiscate Russia's dollar foreign exchange reserves. This made other countries think twice about holding their reserves in the dollar currency. After all, these countries have concluded that their country could be the next if it does not abide by US foreign policy. They can be a victim of secondary sanctions at a minimum. Therefore, it was a natural progression for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to trade with their own national currencies. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said that mechanisms for settlement in national currencies other than Western ones have been successfully created with a number of nations, and the possibility of paying in rubles for certain categories of Russian export goods, including energy and food products, has been set up.
It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens with the dollar now, because I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of weakness of it. Why? Well, because the global economy is slowing down for one key reason. But nonetheless, dollar is normally seen as a safer haven than other currencies. So what you'll find is actually people will go to the dollar in times of emergency, because they know it's actually got depth, liquidity, obviously the Treasury standing behind it. If you were using another currency, those things would not be as strong, and it would not be as straightforward to be able to run a business like that.
The BRICS, SCO, and other international platforms have intensified their multilateral discourse on the subject. And this is very significant, since the US has fallen out of favor with many countries and are gravitating eastward or away from the US. Take the case of Brazil. Presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has recommended using a Latin American currency to be free of the US dollar. Lula has pledged many things that don't involve the US and the dollar, such as strengthening its relations with Latin America, vowing to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The BRICS have also been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency.
Thank you.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil right, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designation as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by nine European states that fund the targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex
of the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just a what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The attacks, the Turkish attack, indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, it's possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France will have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities, and they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Mali says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Mali also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere of influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
The latest spat between Mali and France follows a barrage of accusations and counter-accusations between the two nations. France has apparently completed the withdrawal of its forces from Mali. The withdrawal has ended a 9-year operation in the country. France began its mission in Mali in 2013. The operation was aimed at eradicating militants that Paris claimed were linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France deployed thousands of troops to purportedly prevent separatist forces from reaching Bamako. But the war proved disastrous for Mali and its people. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. Anti-France sentiments are running high among Malians amid the rising civilian death toll. People were long demanding the withdrawal of the troops of their former colonizer.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries.
Mali fell under French colonial rule in 1892, which lasted until 1960. But years after outright colonization, it is still seeking to bring the countries in Africa under its colonial rule. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960. In economic terms, the former French colonies in West Africa are using a common currency that's controlled by the French treasury.
Well, Mali is very important. First of all, it was a French colony. Second of all, the French have maintained some kind of presence, military or otherwise, as well as political and diplomatic influence over the country right after its independence in the 1960s. And from Mali, they could do a lot of surveillance work, intelligence work, and military interference in other countries across the Sahara region, including southern Libya.
Critics say the currency channels more money to France and it strengthens its monetary policy on African nations. In order for that to change, experts say there needs to be a radical change from the past colonial policies.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiyya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, my first and foremost advice to you is to fear Allah. Be His obedient servant. Keep His thought always fresh in your mind. Be attached to and carefully guard the principles Islam which connect you with Him. Can any other connection be stronger, more durable, and more lasting than this? To command greater respect and consideration, or to replace it. Accept good exhortations and refresh your mind with them. adopt piety, and kill your inordinate desires with its help. Build your character with the help of true faith in religion and Allah. Subjugate your nature with the vision of death. Make it see the mortality of life and of all that it holds dear. Force it to realize the actuality of misfortunes and adversities, the changes of circumstances and times, and compel it to study the lives of past people. Persuade it to see the ruined cities, the dilapidated palaces, decaying signs and relics of fallen empires of past nations. Then, meditate over the activities of those people, what they have all done when they were alive and were in power, what they achieved, from where they started their careers, where, when, and how they were brought to an end, where they are now, and what they actually gained out of life, and what was their contributions to the human welfare.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, as we discuss the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, of course we find that this universal persona revolves around divine wisdom, divine knowledge, and the actions and the behaviors and the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam shows us and is this bright shining star where we see that it revolves around the pivot of knowledge and wisdom. When speaking about knowledge and wisdom, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam also speaks about individuals who have decided to pick up the path of ignorance, pick up the path that is opposite to knowledge and wisdom. Now, in order for us to refrain and abstain and not become of the people of ignorance, of course we must know some of the qualities and characteristics of those who are of the people and the path of ignorance. And so, dear friends, here we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, in his universal persona, explains with such great detail the characteristics of one who has selected the path of ignorance. But not only have they selected the path of ignorance, they go one step further and they make things more difficult and confusing, not only for themselves, but for others and the society in general. Sometimes Imam Ali says that an individual will choose the path of ignorance. They will not be a true scholar, and they will sit among the people like a judge trying to solve the problems that are confusing to others, when in reality that individual is confused themselves and they confuse others. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that this individual who has chosen the path of ignorance and this individual who has become a judge among the people trying to solve problems that are confusing, if an ambiguous problem is presented before them, they come up with shabby and flawed and excuses of arguments out of their own whims and their own accord and their own opinions, and then they pass judgment upon its basis. Dear friends, in whatever position that we are in life, we might come across a situation where we have to judge certain things, or we have to measure certain things, or we have to make decisions in our lives. in these places, we have to be very careful that the decision-making process and the process of judging is not based upon our own whims and desires, but that it is based upon the best knowledge available to us. And you know, when an ambiguous problem is presented to an individual or to any of us, it is not obligatory upon us to answer if we do not know what the answer is. The best thing to do is to admit ignorance, as the Ahlul Bayt have taught us that when we don't know the answer to something, we admit that we don't know, and then we go and we search for the truth. A very comprehensive lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء قدير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is the universal aspect of his personality. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he sent the last messenger, the most famous miracle that Allah gave to him was the Quran. But in reality, if you look at it, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala actually blessed the Prophet with two miracles. One was the Quran and other was Ali. They are miracles when you look at the reality of the personality of Ali bin Abi Talib. Quran is the message and Ali is the embodiment of that message. Quran, as it says itself, la rayba fih, it's immune from any error. And Ali has been declared in ayat tathir to be infallible. When you look at the realities, you see that the first formal declaration made by Rasulullah in Mecca introducing Islam, he did not do that only by introducing Islam in himself. He also included Ali as his wasi and his Khalifa. And even the last formal declaration of Rasulullah,
which happened in Ghadir. He doesn't only talk about the Quran, he says, I'm leaving two things as my legacy and the source of guidance. One is the Quran and the other is the Ahlul Bayt. And there, Ali became